How did you sleep last night? It's a common question in our culture, and the answer is not always a positive one. We seem to struggle just a bit with getting the right amount of shut-eye before tumbling out of bed to face the day. It should not surprise you to find that we've changed the idea of sleep, certainly since we got electric lights and long shifts at the factory. Benjamin Reese tells us how much in his book Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. Benjamin is a professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta. His writing focuses on American cultural history with an emphasis on health, race, and disability. He's the co-founder and co-director of the Disability Studies Initiative at Emory. Benjamin, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You ask a paragraph worth of great questions at the start of the book, the central one being, if sleep is something that happens naturally, why do we struggle with it?
Yeah, really complicated question. And, you know, it's made even more puzzling by the fact that we have more comfortable and hygienic sleeping arrangements for a greater number of people than ever before in human history. So why do people feel so stressed out about getting a good night's sleep? And the answer, it seemed to me, has nothing to do with change in our bodies, but has to do with the change in the way that we view sleep and the expectations that we bring to sleep, which are actually pretty strange when you start to look at them closely.
How recent is the concept of sleeping straight through the night in what you call an almost neurotically sealed space?
Yeah, well, that's actually two things sleep that are strange: sleeping through the night and sealing yourself up in a specially appointed room that you try to close off from noise, and you use climate control to give you an optimal temperature and all this kind of stuff. Neither of these things really seems to have been practiced anywhere before around the 19th century. We know that today there's still a lot of napping cultures, but what I think a lot of people are surprised to find is that in Europe and North America, what we call the West, that it was common practice for people to break up their sleep at night into two or even more shifts. So the idea of sleeping all at one, doing all your sleep 7 or 8 hours in a row is a relatively recent phenomenon. And then that idea of the special room, the neurotically sealed room, most homes didn't have bedrooms before about the 19th century. That was something, the ability to spread out in space was something that was reserved for really wealthy people and aristocrats up until about the late 18th, early 19th century. And when there was enough wealth to spread around, and middle class homes could afford rooms with, you know, special rooms for sleeping, they started to send children out into those rooms. Also, families were a lot bigger. So it's just something that hasn't been available to people through most of history, and now we insist that this is the way we're supposed to do it. And I think there can be a backlash or some unintended consequences.
You do not tell us how to sleep best. This is not that kind of a book. But and obviously, you know, what good sleep means is going to be variable person to person. But how variable did you find it to be society to society?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's amazing when you think about sleep as being this thing that everybody has to do. And certainly there are biological constants. I mean, sleep is generally attuned to patterns of light and darkness and to shifts in temperature. And in most societies, they do the bulk of their sleeping at night. But beyond that, it's it's kind of a free for all, and every society seems to develop their own rules. You know, who you sleep with, how many people do you try to do all your sleep at once, or do you break it up? Do you take naps at certain times? Where do you sleep? Do you change your pattern according to season? Do you sleep naked or do you sleep clothed? Do you sleep in public or in private? I mean, these are all things that are subject to negotiation, and we have one pretty narrow set of rules around it that that don't work for some people, and I think that's part of the reason why a lot of people feel stressed about their sleep.
So then you just mentioned, though, with whom we sleep. I mean, you found many answers to that around the world, apparently, and certainly even in our own culture, just back in time.
Yeah, I mean, through the I would say the late 18th, early 19th century, it was common for people in the U.S., in Europe, when they traveled, to share beds with strangers. And that was simply a part of traveling, and intense friendships could form. The idea of having a separate bed available is something that's really, for a roadside hotel, you would go in and say, I want to sleep alone in that space. Just wouldn't have been available to travelers until fairly recently, by the long span of history. Children sleeping with parents. I mean, we're told in our society that that is something that's essential. It's essential to have children move apart from the parents, often from a very early age, as early as 6 months. That's connected with proper psychosexual development, and also with our ideas of privacy around sex and so on for adults. For most people the world over through history, completely unthinkable, and it would have been seen as cruel. And yet again, we're kind of fixated on this as a default model for how we're supposed to sleep. We know it doesn't work for a lot of kids. They want to crawl into bed. So part of what I tried to do in the book is to say, let's take these frustrations that we have with sleep and try to examine, where do they come from historically, and what are the different kinds of arrangements for sleep around the world that people often are steered away from in our society.
I noticed that you and neurologist David Rye co-taught a sleep in science and culture session at Emory. Was that well attended?
Yeah, well, it was a course. We taught a semester-long course, and we had students from all across different areas of the university, from the medical school, from the humanities, from the business school, all kind of getting their minds around the social and the biological meanings of sleep. It was a great experience. I learned a ton from it.
And we're learning a ton from you. Benjamin Reese is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. We're trying not to get 40 winks while we're talking about this because it does sound a little inviting, but we'll talk more with Benjamin and take phone calls and emails from you when we come back to the Exchange. As we go to the break, I'll remind you, this is day one of our Spring Fund Drive, funding for public radio, very important right now. Your pledge of support, welcome at 888-552-6191 or ijpr.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Benjamin Reese from Emory University in Atlanta. He's written a book called Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World, that actually we seem to do lousier at getting sleep in a time when we shouldn't know a whole lot more about how to provide good sleep. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. There's an overall sense, certainly in the first part of the book, Benjamin, about the idea that we have to train ourselves to sleep. I mean, once we know how to go to the bathroom and a toilet, and once we know how to feed ourselves, it seems like these are skills we're pretty good at, but not sleeping?
Yeah, we got to train our kids first, and sometimes train by more than one system if the first one we try doesn't work. And then throughout life, as we adapt to new circumstances, often people feel like they have to train themselves to do it all over again. I mean, there's such a brisk business in self-help books around sleep. I tried not to, add to that. I'm not, as you said, I'm not telling people what's the best way to do it. But people are so eager to get expert advice on how to do it in the right way. It just seems so strange to me. You know, we've gotten on as a species for millennia, and all other species don't seem to need this. You know, why is it in the last 100, 150 years that suddenly people feel like they're not doing it right?
Well, and then in the last 100, 150 years, we've got things like shift work in factories and electric lights. So those must figure prominently in the changes in sleep patterns.
Yeah, I mean, the huge shift in sleep patterns in really over the last 200 years or so. You know, you talk about industrialization and what that did to people's circadian rhythms, where, again, as I said, we're sort of programmed to be responsive to changes in light and temperature in the way we sleep and wake up. But when you're supposed to show up on the factory floor at 8 a.m., same time every day, regardless of season, you are suddenly responding to a different set of cues than you were, say, if you lived in an agrarian society where you had tasks beginning at sunrise, and you would work more or less till sundown. Your sleep would change quite a bit according to season in the earlier kind of society. But all sorts of things followed along with industrialization. So, schools for children, as the parents started to work out of the home, it was important to send children to school. So compulsory education getting kids on a standardized routine every morning, same time. Transportation, trains, you had to time yourself to get onto the train, communications with telegraph and then later with, you know, radio programs and telephones and all that kind of stuff. We started living much more by the clock and by mechanical time and trying to turn our bodies in a way into machines that would be calibrated with these systems. The other big pressure that comes along with this is the need to, you know, think about sleep in terms of economic benefits. And I see a lot of this today about how important it is to, you know, the productivity of a company to get their workers, well rested and on a proper sleep schedule and so on. I think when we start to think about sleep in that way, we put a lot of pressure on it. And that can create a lot of psychological stress around getting to sleep at night.
So rather than feeling sleepy, it's like, you know, okay, it's 10 o'clock, be sleepy.
Yeah, right. Be sleepy because I got to get up and you know, be in the office at 8 o'clock. I got to catch subway or drive, and I got to be safe while I'm driving. I can't be too sleepy. Oh, my God. You know, that's a very modern kind of anxiety, that I'm going to crash my car or, you know, do something, subject myself to some kind of risk with heavy machinery, or I'm just not going to be at peak efficiency for that presentation I have to make at, you know, at 9:30 a.m. if I don't get to sleep. Oh, my God, I got to fall asleep. So I think a lot of our sleep anxiety relates to these kinds of new economic and technological pressures. And then you mentioned artificial light, electric light. It really changed. You know, people could stay up much, much later than sunset and engage in all kinds of activities. So, you know, reading, entertaining. Later we had radio, you know, other kinds of home entertainments that provide inducements for people to stay up later. That really changed people's sleep patterns. And now we have, of course, the Internet that's available 24/7. And it's not only a distraction and a source of more work that takes place in the home, but the light that comes from these screens really scrambles our brains and tricks our brains into thinking that it's daylight. So even after you turn off a computer screen, your brain may think that it's still daytime, and it's much harder to shut down. So, you know, so a lot has changed affecting sleep.
Benjamin Reese is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. So it is true then that at one time humans at least report talking report sleeping in two batches with a little quiet period in between?
Yeah. So that's the historian Roger Ekirch wrote a wonderful book that has a chapter on this. Book is called A Day's Close. And he found that it was really common in European society before the advent of industrialization and powerful artificial lighting for people to break up their sleep in this way. And there would be this interval in between. Sometimes it was called the watch, in which people would interpret their dreams. They would pray. It was thought to be a time of heightened fertility, so sometimes there were rituals of lovemaking. And this is something that is, you know, now often considered to be called sleep maintenance insomnia, where you can't stay asleep through the night. There have been a lot of other studies done by anthropologists and biologists about people who sleep in circumstances where they don't have artificial light and electricity. And they find a fragmentation of sleep, not always just in two bits, but sometimes in three or four bits. And I heard a fascinating lecture by an anthropologist who was studying a group in Madagascar, and he found that, you know, among about 2,000 people in this village, there was no time in the night when everybody was sleeping. There were always groups of people who were awake, and there was a security issue involved in, you know, standing watch and that kind of thing. So, but now we sort of expect everybody to, you know, lights out at 11, up at 7, or something like that. And if you deviate from it, you pop a pill or you think something's wrong with you. It doesn't fit with most of history.
I love the stories in here about the examinations of what happened in places with very cold climates in the days before electric lights, and what some of the small villages would do when the nights were very long and very cold.
Yeah, well, especially in regions that are far from the equator, where there was a tremendous amount of seasonal variation, there are reports that entire villages would almost shut down for a couple of months in the winter. You know, they would get up and stoke the fire, and they would eat a little bit, but they would spend a tremendous amount of time in bed. And in the 19th century, there was one report in a British medical journal about the possibilities for human hibernation, saying, is what they're doing the same thing as what bears do? And, of course, humans can't hibernate. Our brains aren't structured that way. But it just goes to show you, you know, and it makes a certain amount of sense. When there's much less light available and it's much colder and your food supply is more limited, it would make sense to do what you can to conserve energy and stay in bed longer in the winter and stay up longer in the summer when you're either harvesting or hunting and, you know, trying to gather as much fat and protein as you can for the lean months. But now if people stayed in bed that way 16 hours in the winter, it would be seasonal affective disorder, right?
Oh, sure, yeah, yeah, that's right, that would be viewed that way. I'm struck by the fact that you point out that a lot of the 20th century sleep studies were funded by people who wanted workers to sleep less or at least function with less or be better soldiers on little sleep and stuff like that. Ultimately, did science figure out if there is a 24-hour body cycle that dictates X amount of sleep within that time?
Yeah, it's interesting the field of chronobiology is the field that studies timing mechanisms of living things, including humans. And they're really fascinated in this question of what is the relation between our internal clocks and external pressures, whether that's social pressures or, changes in the environment, seasonal changes, that kind of stuff. And what I understand is that for most people, the internal clock is set slightly off from 24 hours. It's not. You would think it would be exactly 24, but it's more like 24 and a half. And one of the theories for why this is so is that being slightly off kilter with the pattern of sunrise and sunfall, sunset, is that it makes us a little bit more adaptable to changes. So if we're traveling, or if something occurs that where we need to be up in the middle of the night, if we're just slightly off kilter all the time, we become a little bit more flexible. But yeah, so we do have these timing mechanisms that are roughly cued to patterns of light and dark and changes in temperature.
Chronobiology, that's a great term. Let's go backwards in time though and bring Henry David Thoreau in here. What did he say about sleep in Walden?
Yeah, well, you know, so I'm an English professor. I know it may not sound like it. I've kind of gone far afield with this project, but this book really, in some ways, got its start from a reading of Walden. I was teaching that course with the neurologist that you mentioned, and at the same time, I was teaching Walden in an undergraduate class, and I started to see that the whole thing was really about sleep and waking. I mean, in every chapter, there's just beautiful observations about the rhythms of nature and when, creatures come out from their holes in the wintertime and when the leaves change or fall. But he was also interested in human patterns of cyclical change according to day and night and spring, summer, and winter. And it seemed like a very modern book when I started looking at it through that lens. You know, he goes off to Walden Pond to try to acclimate his own body rhythms in part to the natural world around him. But he talks a lot about going into town and watching people. And he says, I've never met a man who is fully awake. And the reasons that all these people are kind of stumbling around like zombies, felt very contemporary to me. He was writing in the 1850s.
Right.
But people jolting down huge amounts of coffee, trying to get themselves to work on time. And they're sort of jacked up by sensationalistic media. At one point he talks about, he said that, he knew of one guy who couldn't sleep for an hour without waking up and demanding to know what the news is. And I had this image in my mind's eye, somebody reaching for a smartphone, the 19th century version of a smartphone in the middle of the night, clicking on Facebook or whatever. So I think he's responding to a set of changes in sleep-wake patterns in the 19th century around industrialization and technological change that gave us the kind of broken sleep that we've inherited.
Ultimately, Benjamin, what do you think we're missing in our efforts to better understand or control sleep?
I think the main thing that we're missing is the idea that sleep is a part of our social lives. And I know that may seem counterintuitive because we think about sleep as the private thing. You know, we go and we shut out the social world. We're dead to the world, right? But the way we do it, you know, is that is determined by our society. It's not so much there's no one single natural way to do it. Every society has different rules about it. But the way that we're expected to sleep is, you know, conditions are very personal and private experience of sleeping. I think thinking of it in that way rather than saying, oh, it's all in my head or it's just there's something wrong with me, I think it might give people a little bit looser, more flexible sense of how they might get the job done.
Is anything different in the way you approach sleep at your house with your family?
Yeah, I'm less rigid about my own sleep patterns. If I'm up in the middle of the night, I'll kind of accept it and embrace it, and I might work for a little bit. I might read. I'll try to find time to nap during the day if I can. So yeah, I'm a little more flexible about it. My kids are big now, so I can't have a do-over in terms of how we got them to do it, But I try to be a little more laissez-faire about it.
It does seem like relaxing a bit about it, you know, not just tossing and turning, going, darn, I can't sleep. Just get up. Use the time. And then come back to bed.
For some people, you can't avoid it. I mean, if you've got, if you're an airline pilot or, work in a nuclear plant or whatever, where you got to be at peak efficiency, you sort of got to accept the rules that we have in our society. There's not much you can do about it. But, for those who can, maybe a bit of flexibility and kind of being lenient on yourself might help you more than trying to reprogram yourself.
There's a fun blend of history and science and literature, and the book is called Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. It's the work of Benjamin Reese, professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta. Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, take care.